From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And former FBI Director James Comey has been testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee, his first public statement since President Trump fired him on May 9th as he was leading the FBI investigation into potential coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been listening. And Greg, the biggest question going in today, I feel, was did President Trump try to impede the investigation, particularly in that private White House dinner with Comey? So what did we hear today?
Well, Comey gave this 7-page prepared testimony yesterday, and then the questioning has focused on that quite extensively, almost entirely. Comey talked about several things that came up. One was this dinner he had with Trump just a week into office, January 27th, where the president asked for loyalty, and Comey said, I told him I would give him honesty, and the president said honest loyalty. But this sort of represented this awkward relationship they had right from the beginning, and this sense that Trump was not going to respect the norm of independence from the FBI director.
Well, most important, Comey says that the president asked him to back off the investigation of Michael Flynn, the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had not revealed his connections to the Russians. And Comey says that Trump said he'd hoped he'd back off that. And then Senator James Risch of Idaho hammered down on how maybe hoping for something isn't in order. Here's Comey's response.
I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the president of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
Greg, people are looking for the smoking gun to obstruction of justice. Is that it?
Well, that is certainly the focus of the conversation. But Comey himself was asked that, and he said it's not for me to say. And this is something he said would have to play out through the legal channels and the multiple investigations. He did say it was very disturbing. This is why he took copious notes. I mean, it was strange right from the get-go. This happened on February 14th at an Oval Office meeting, a counterterrorism briefing. Other senior officials, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions, were asked to leave, and it was just Trump and Comey one-on-one. So Comey's antenna immediately went up. This is very strange. He thought something big was about to happen. He was absolutely paying rapt attention. And he went back and discussed this with his senior staff at the FBI, and they held on to it but didn't make it public.
Well, he was asked why he took notes of the meetings, and he said, first of all, the nature of the conversation was so serious, then this.
And then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document.
Well, and Senator Dianne Feinstein asked him later, instead of documenting, why didn't he stop the president and say, you know, these conversations are inappropriate? And here's Comey's response to that.
It's a great question. Maybe if I were stronger, I would have. I was so stunned by the conversation that I just took it in. And the only thing I could think to say, because I was playing in my mind, because I was going to remember every word he said, I was playing in my mind, what should my response be? And that's why I very carefully chose the words. And look, I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
This is the tweet that President Trump then sent out sort of as a threat to James Comey, saying, I may have tapes, or maybe tapes of our conversations. Look, there was pushback as well, Greg Myrie, on him. I'm thinking of Marco Rubio saying, what really came out of this?
Right. And others, other senators followed up and said, well, he asked you here on February 14th, did he ever follow up? I mean, it's not that the president is shy about asking for something. So Comey said, no, it didn't come up again. And he didn't know the reason for that. Again, very disturbed at the time that it happened. He took these notes, shared it with his staff, but it didn't come up again from the White House or from the president.
The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., has been tweeting today to the notion that you wouldn't really understand what his father, the president, was saying to you, which is what James Comey seems to be saying. I'm not sure what I was hearing. He said, my father is never, ambiguous. If he tells you to do something, you'd know. But how about President Trump? Have we heard from him?
We haven't. We understand that he's watching the testimony and with his outside lawyer, but he has not spoken. They did release a brief statement yesterday saying that it proved Trump's statement that Comey told him three times he was not under investigation. Comey repeated that today at his testimony.
Okay, big day. Entertainment Weekly, by the way, is tweeting out all the celebrities that are paying attention to the hearings today, but NPR will be all day. We'll be having continuous coverage. Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent, will check back in with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, North Carolina lawmakers are going into special session today. Governor Roy Cooper is putting pressure on them to redraw election maps after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this week which struck down political maps. The ruling said state lawmakers illegally gerrymandered 28 legislative districts and that the districts were drawn to disadvantage black voters. Since 2011, more than a dozen Republican-backed laws in North Carolina have been struck down in federal and state courts. From Here and Now contributor WUNC, Jeff Tiberi reports.
For 6 years, Republicans have been making the laws in North Carolina, and Democrats have frequently been taking them to court. A voter ID law overturned for discriminating against black and Latino voters, a plan to remove career status for veteran teachers struck down for violating contract law, and local, state, and federal redistricting plans ruled unlawful for being illegal racial gerrymanders. In December, weeks after the Republican governor was defeated, lawmakers convened a special session to strip the incoming Democratic executive of some powers. Then Governor-elect Roy Cooper offered this.
If I believe that laws passed by the legislature hurt working families and are unconstitutional, they will see me in court, and they don't have a very good track record there.
Cooper did sue, and in the months to follow did it again and again. Calculating the judicial track record of lawmakers is challenging. There is a maze of filings, injunctions, rulings, dismissals, and upcoming arguments. In some instances, both sides declare to win. Meredith College political science professor David McLennan summarizes it like this.
I think right now we look at it as, you know, a lot of victories for Democrats or progressives in the state and a few for Republicans.
In 2011, when Republicans took over the North Carolina legislature for the first time in more than a century, they moved swiftly to implement a conservative policy agenda. Lawsuits followed. State laws are regularly challenged in civil and criminal cases, generally one person disputing a law as it affects them. Then there are a few more broad challenges, constitutional claims, which often come from interest groups. An analysis of these broader challenges since 2011 shows that three laws were ultimately upheld, surviving intact. 17 laws were either overturned altogether or had key provisions struck down. At least four prominent cases are still pending.
We live in an era where everything that is legislated is litigated.
John Davis is a nonpartisan political analyst. Since Republicans claim control of the state legislature, close to 2,000 bills have become law. The overwhelming majority of those were not controversial and passed with wide bipartisan support. But some of the legislation has been highly contentious, redistricting, abortion regulations, and election rules among them. Lawmakers have spent close to $13 million on outside counsel defending these laws. Governor Roy Cooper has spent more than $400,000 on his legal fights. Yes, that's all taxpayer money. As for those 17 laws struck down, some were ruled unconstitutional in the state Supreme Court, others in federal court, and a few by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia. Analyst John Davis.
Their biggest barrier has been a federal district court in Richmond with 15 members, 10 of whom were appointed by Democrats, 5 by Republicans.
For a case to even get to the appellate level, it often signals that Republicans prevailed in a lower court. The bench in Virginia was once considered among the most conservative of the appellate courts. Today, that has changed, and it's widely considered among the most liberal.
So basically, the deck has been stacked against them. Unfortunately, as bad as I hate to say it, there truly is an ideological bias on the U.S. Supreme Court and on all these federal courts.
Like the many lawsuits against the North Carolina legislature that are still pending, the balance of power among judges who rule on all these claims is fluid. With only an 8-justice Supreme Court, the role of the Fourth Circuit was enhanced for more than a year. However, the dynamic may be changing, with Justice Neil Gorsuch recently joining the High Court. Again, political scientist David McLennan.
What happens in the next 6 to 12 months could change what we've experienced over the last couple of years in terms of victories for liberals or progressives.
One of the conservatives who is glad to see a change on the Supreme Court is Republican State Representative David Lewis.
I think that many of the decisions that the Fourth Circuit have made have been purely political and have been designed to be not only political but inflammatory. And I hope that the Supreme Court will step in and put the brakes on some of this miscarriage of justice.
Lewis was the primary sponsor of the voter ID law, enacted by North Carolina lawmakers in 2013, ruled unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit last summer, and declined to be heard on appeal by the U.S. Supreme Court in May. But Lewis indicated another voting law is possible in the coming weeks, and there's a decent chance another legal challenge will follow. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi.
Today would be the architect Frank Lloyd Wright's 150th birthday. Over his 7-decade career, Wright developed a distinctly modern American style. Some of his best-known buildings are the Guggenheim Museum in New York and Falling Water, built over a waterfall in Pennsylvania. He also designed furniture, windows, and lighting for his buildings. Joining us now is Frank Lloyd Wright scholar Catherine Smith. And Catherine Smith, first of all, can you just tell us about the Frank Lloyd Wright style?
Yes, I sure can, but I just want to start out by saying that Frank Lloyd Wright didn't believe in styles. He thought that meant architecture was fashion. So what he actually did do was to create a series of principles or ideas.
And what were those principles and ideas?
Well, the principle, I would start with the first one, and this is in between 1893 and 1902. He said about to be opposing the historic European architecture from ancient Greece to the Victorian England period that was dominating architecture at the turn of the century. And he wanted to create a work and buildings that were designed to human scale, free of European ornamentation, and also an honest expression of materials.
And was there something American about it, do you think?
Absolutely. He defined it in those terms completely. He was influenced by his mentor, Louis Sullivan, who was the greatest architect of the end of the 19th century. He was based in Chicago, Illinois. And so the philosophy behind this was that the United States was a young country, and it deserved its own genuine, true, original architecture, not the architecture of ancient Greece or the Roman Empire.
Now, there are several iconic buildings from Frank Lloyd Wright, Falling Water and the Guggenheim Museum. What do you think makes those so remarkable?
Well, those are the two that are best known to the general public, and they're almost polar opposites in the sense that one is the Falling Water is sited deeply into a beautiful glen in a wooded forest area, and the Guggenheim Museum is right there on Fifth Avenue. So what he was trying to do in either case was to bring a human scale to the building, and in Falling Water you can see his attention to integrating a work of architecture with a beautiful natural landscape site.
What's your favorite Frank Lloyd Wright building?
Well, I have to say, and this is personal on my part, is my favorite is his own house and studio in Wisconsin, which is called Taliesin. And I've been able through the years to be a guest there. I think I've slept in almost every bedroom in the house. Hmm. And it's an exquisite building that's defines actually a term which is Japanese, which is called wabi-sabi. And wabi-sabi is the design philosophy of a rustic, simplistic, simple building that fits itself with nature. And Taliesin is the perfect example of that.
Do you think there's something Midwestern about Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, I do. Yes, I do. Because it kept him from being integrated into, you know, the East Coast attitude, which is to be closer to Europe. And he was born in 1867. So he was on the edge of the frontier That's really hard for some of us to believe.
Right.
But Wisconsin only became a state in 1848. So he was a pioneer.
So what do you think is his lasting legacy all these years later?
His lasting legacy is, of course, his built work. He designed just over 1,000, and just half of those are still standing today. But I really feel his legacy is for your audience, and they have homes, and they have a great ability now through his ideas to have your house relate to nature. And through that understanding of nature, we can perhaps address some of the major concerns of sustainability which exist in our era today.
That's Catherine Smith, who is a Frank Lloyd Wright scholar and author of a number of books. Her most recent is Wright on Exhibit, Frank Lloyd Wright's Architectural Exhibitions, talking to us on the 150th birthday of Frank Lloyd Wright. Catherine Smith, thank you.
Well, just great to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, because Frank Lloyd Wright designed so many homes, there are plenty of people in this country who have lived in his art, including Kim Bixler, who grew up in a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Rochester, New York, that her parents owned from 1977 to 1994. Kim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And describe the house for us.
Well, the house was built in 1908, so it was a prairie-style home. It was built around the same time as the Roby House, which is much more famous in Illinois, but it was very, very similar. He wanted a house that kind of fit the landscape, not fought the landscape. It also was like a craftsman-style feel to the house, and the house has 253 stained glass, art glass windows, doors, and light lenses throughout. It's just really spectacular with the lighting.
Did you realize how special it was when you were living in it?
Well, we moved in when I was 8 years old, and right from the beginning, my mom handed me a stack of note cards and said, okay, time to give your first tour. So I used to give tours to architecture students and professors and charities, community groups. So I became pretty familiar with my house. But as I became a teenager, I became very self-conscious and kind of uncomfortable with the house because I felt like people were judging me based on where I lived. And now, of course, I look back and I say, oh, that was such a treasure and such a gem to live there at that time.
Well, what kind of impression did it leave on you and other people who visited the house? I mean, you know, we all go into a lot of different houses throughout our lives, but was there something that was really different about going into your house?
Well, the house still has 17 pieces of original furniture that were designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. So when you walk into the dining room, which is truly the most spectacular room in the house, and it has all of the Frank Lloyd Wright furniture, the chairs, you can see his vision, his total vision. And I'd have a friend come over, and they would just, you know, stop and gasp. And I remember an architect, he came through the house, and he kind of swayed for a minute, and he said, to imagine the imagination of the person who imagined this room. And what the house has is it has all these geometric shapes throughout the house. So the shapes from the windows are the same size as the shapes on the light fixtures, and then that same shape is repeated in the furniture. And so when you walk in, you're not really aware, but you know that there's just this beauty of that room. And it's really quite spectacular.
Now, lest we just talk about the good things in this house, I know that there were also some problems with it. What were they?
Oh, my gosh. Well, typical of many Frank Lloyd Wright homes, the roof was a huge problem. It leaked, and, you know, we were always being summoned out of bed, go grab the pots and pans, get every towel in the house. So, like, every flat roof, I mean, if you did not go out there and start shoveling, this is Rochester, New York, and they have these series of flat roofs that were abutting these clear-story windows in the dining room, and the heat from the house, as the snow was piling up, would melt that snow, and we would create all these water problems, ice dams, and it was a continuous problem. So when my parents purchased the house, the roof cost as much as the house did to repair it.
Well, do you think that Frank Lloyd Wright just missed that part of it, that he or did he just not care about anything but the look and the feel?
I really think that he felt that he wanted it to look beautiful, and you know, the homeowner would have to deal with that. And, you know, there's some famous stories, some wonderful stories that someone wrote to him and said, you know, there's water leaking on my desk, you know, from the roof. And he just wrote back and said, move your desk. you know, for us, it was just a constant, constant battle. But when we did finally repair it, my parents really tried to do it the right way. They took off 7 roofs. Each person was stacking another roof on another roof and another roof. And they went down right to the boards and then put a copper roof on it. And it maintained, it stayed that way for quite a while. But it was definitely an issue for us.
Why did your parents decide to sell the house after 17 years?
Oh, my gosh. My mom never wanted to leave. She really loved the house. She said, if I could put it on a flatbed trailer and take it with me, I would have. But it was Rochester, New York, and my parents are from California, and they were done. The repairs were constant. You know, we went through 3,000 gallons of oil every year to heat the house. We lived in basically one room of the house a lot of times and put on lots of sweaters and literally blankets. So there were definitely some downsides to that house.
If somebody out there is considering buying a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and there are a few on the market right now, what would you tell them?
Yes. You know, be prepared. You have to really love it. You know, make sure you have a pretty deep pocketbook. The people who bought the house in 2009, the current owners, when they first bought the house, they did a pressure test of the house, and it came out as a zero. So basically, you could put your hand in front of one of these art glass windows, and you could feel the breeze coming in. But they made sure that everything was tightened up and done properly. So you can do it that way. Spare no expense. The other approach is just absolutely love it and put on another sweater and, you know, get some extra buckets.
That's Kim Bixler, who is author of the book Growing Up in a Frank Lloyd Wright House, based on her own experience there in Rochester, New York. Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can see some photos of Frank Lloyd Wright homes at our website, hereandnow.org. We'll also have information about where you can go to actually see a Frank Lloyd Wright house for yourself. Some of them are opening up to the public for his 150th birthday.
And with all the attention on today's Senate hearings, you'd be forgiven for missing the revelations about ethics waivers in the Trump administration. Now, these waivers allow federal employees to avoid ethics rules. The White House fought making theirs public, but the Office of Government Ethics has just won that tug of war. The documents are now online. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax joins us now from Washington, where since the election, she's been focused on Trump-related ethics issues. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Robin.
So the waivers, what have we learned?
Well, the Office of Government Ethics first released this one wave of documents that showed White House staffers. That was released last week, and there were a lot of big-name players on that. The list included Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, Chief of Strategist Steve Bannon, the Presidential Counselor Kellyanne Conway. So those big-name folks have these waivers. One example would be Bannon, who used to head Breitbart News, is free to continue to meet privately with that media outlet. And then yesterday, we got a new round of these waivers, and they show former lobbyists who are working for federal agencies, not the White House itself, but these agencies, and they too are exempt from certain ethics rules.
So give us an example of that.
Well, there's one that stood out. That's Lance Leggett. Last year, he lobbied to influence Medicare policy at Health and Human Services. Now he's got the ethics waiver, and he's the chief of staff at HHS.
So jump in. So he was a lawyer. He was outside the government. He was working for a law firm lobbying to influence Medicare policy.
Exactly. That's the classic revolving door in Washington. A lot of people who voted for Trump said that they wanted to drain the swamp, but these waivers show all this muddy water is still pretty much here. And there's another thing. A lot of names didn't show up on the list. So some critics are saying, wait a minute, there are a lot more lobbyists than are on this list. They're wondering if there aren't some loopholes that they're using to get around having to even reveal these waivers.
Okay, so that's the waivers. But while we have you, there's other ethics news. This week, Forbes reported that President Trump's son, Eric, steered money to the Trump Organization while putting on charity events. Explain.
Well, Forbes, you know, is not exactly a left-wing news organization, and they reported on these tax documents that showed the Eric Trump Foundation had shifted money from this charity golf tournament to it was supposed to all go to St. Jude's Children's Hospital, but it was going into the Trump Organization. Now, Eric had headed this annual event. It was held at a Trump golf course in Westchester County, New York, and he had told Forbes that the golf course was free, but the document showed that actually it was the for-profit Trump Organization getting these huge fees. So, for example, in 2015 alone, the company charged $322,000 for a round of golf.
That's not free. That is not free.
Yeah, we know.
Eric Trump is slamming that story, saying he raised millions for St. Jude's. But the point is, people always question, wait a second, how much of the money that I'm paying for a charity event is actually going to that charity and how much is being siphoned off? And here an example of $322,000. They said it was free, but $322,000 for a round of golf going to the Trump Organization. Marilyn G. Wax, we have to have you back to talk about a new hotel chain that the Trump Organization is starting. We will do that.
Alrighty.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's time for a Texas edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
I woke up still not dead again today.
Joe Nick Petoskey hosts the Texas Music Hour of Power at Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas, which is about 60 miles from the border with Mexico. Joe Nick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And you play a lot of different styles on your show, but all out of Texas. Tell us about some of them before we hear them.
Well, Texas is a mishmash of a lot of sounds, and it has a lot of different indigenous musics. You know, the basic food groups of American music, country, and blues. Texans kind of have ownership of both those sounds. And then there's all kinds of other sounds running around, like Western swing, jazz, country, original music. You know, there's things like zydeco and conjunto and tejano. There's all kinds of musics, and part of the goal of this show is to play all the Texas musics we got.
All right, well, let's get to some of it. And first, you wanted us to hear from someone who has been at this for a while. This is Delbert McClinton featuring Jimmy Vaughn and Luann Barton with Don't Do It.
We were all down at South Street when the bottle fell out. Somebody screamed, "What you talking about?" I heard a glass break and somebody moan. Saw Raymond running out the front door, screaming into his cell phone. Don't do it. There must be something I can do. Please don't do it. Let me make it up to you. We've been together so long. Baby, please hold on. Don't do it.
So how would you describe this?
Well, it depends how you want to describe it. Delbert's been described as country. That's definitely rhythm and blues and a lot of that, what we call Texas shuffle. It's got a swing to it. And, of course, Jimmy Vaughn is the older brother of Stevie Vaughn. He's one of the great interpreters of modern American blues music. So blues, rock and roll. This is a guy that taught harmonica to John Lennon of the Beatles before the Beatles became the Beatles. He's been around, so it's Texas music. That's what we call it.
He's 76 years old, Delbert McClinton.
Yeah, and he's still, you know, he's got some chops. That's brand new music from his latest album.
All right, well, next you wanted us to hear from the Austin group Shiny Ribs. This is called Trouble Trouble.
Yeah, when the devil come a call, don't you answer that door no more. He lay with a banker and a family, break up our show.
Hey, the trouble will pass. The trouble will pass.
So on Twitter, this group refers to itself, and by the way, this would sound so much better if you were saying it than me, but here we go. The Baryshnikov of the Big Thicket, the Pavarotti of the Piney Woods, the Redneck Parliament, Walt Whitman of Thumb Wrestling, the Bruce Lee of ukulele.
That's Kevin Russell in a nutshell. He comes from the southeast corner of Texas called the Golden Triangle, where so much great music like George Jones, Johnny Winter, Janis Joplin, people like that came out of that corner of the state, and, you know, that's, to me, Texas music once again. What you want to call it, well, depends how you describe things.
Well, and how would you describe this style of music?
Well, I think it's definitely roots music, and a lot of people pigeonhole it as Americana. And if you want to talk Americana, I make the argument that all started in Austin in the early 70s when Willie Nelson, Doug Somm, folks like Willis Allen Ramsey, Jerry Jeff Walker, all and Sleep at the Wheel are all moving to town and mixing up traditional sounds and basically making it new.
Okay, well, the next selection from you is Down in the Barrio by Los Tex-Maniacs with Alejandro Escovedo.
Way down in the barrio, something that we all know. The bullets are flying and people are dying for reasons they don't even know. Down in the barrio, down in the barrio.
Okay, let's talk about that accordion first.
Yeah, that's Josh Baca. And accordion's a big deal in Texas, and especially in Tejano and Conjunto music, what we call Tex-Mex. And it's usually elders that are recognized, like the great Flaco Jimenez or Esteban Jordan, the Jimi Hendrix of accordion. But this generation's great accordionist is Josh Baca. I've got my eyes on him. He is a hot player, and I'm looking forward to seeing where he's going to take this Tex-Mex sound.
And do you hear a lot of the Tex-Mex sound where you are in Marfa, which, as we said, is not too far from the Mexican border?
Well, you've got to understand the Tri-County area, which is as big as Connecticut, 10,000 people, they call it the Trans-Pecos Big Bend, is bicultural, and it's bilingual. I mean, it really is. It's in the air. So on my show, there's a lot of Freddie Fender, the great classics like Lydia Mendoza, Narciso Martinez, Isidro Lopez. Well, actually, one of my favorites is Piñata Protest, which are the Ramones of Conjunto polka music. So I know it sounds strange, but you got to hear it, and it sounds actually kind of natural.
All right, well, you wanted us to hear from a group out of Crosby, Texas, originally from Louisiana. This is Jerome Baptiste and the Zydeco Players with Creole Country Boy, Volume 1.
I'm a call up a buck, but I'm a shoot a doe this time, y'all.
So I remember going to a Zydeco show years ago in Maryland with a friend who is just a huge Zydeco fan. How big is it in Texas?
Well, on a given Saturday night, there's more Zydeco being played in Houston than anywhere.
Hmm.
I mean, it's associated with Southwest Louisiana, which is really where it came from, rural Louisiana. But the Creole migration to Houston, you got to look at Houston in that context as being L.A., the promised land. So there are loads of Zydeco bands and contemporary bands, some that are mixing hip-hop in instead of rhythm and blues or country sounds. Little Brian is Zydeco Travelers, Jabbo, Step Rito, Leroy Thomas, and all these groups are led by an accordion, but they often sing in French. And like I said, Houston is probably the epicenter of Zydeco music today.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and you wanted us to hear a song that everyone will recognize, although probably not this version. Let's listen. Now, this is someone that you mentioned, Flaco Jimenez and Buck Owens.
Right, and it's kind of a way of demonstrating that Texans don't observe borders or boundaries or color lines when it comes to music. You've got Buck Owens, who is the creator of the Bakersfield sound in Southern California, but he came out of Sherman, Texas, up by the Oklahoma line. And then Flaco Jimenez is really the great exporter of the Tex-Mex accordion, discovery of Doug Somm. He's played with everyone from Bob Dylan to the Rolling Stones. He's out of San Antonio, and what better song to kind of collaborate on but a Beatles song? And that is the least Beatles-sounding Beatles song.
Absolutely.
That you've heard in at least the last 24 hours. Right. I would challenge you on that one. But that's Texas. And forget who we are, you know, in the political realm or whatever. Culturally, we're just a wonderful mishmash. And that's why I love Texas music. And we've got a great recorded body of work that goes back to the 1920s. But it's here and now, and it's happening.
And your favorite city in Texas is?
Marfa, Texas.
Of course, right where you are. Joe Nick Potosky hosts the Texas Music Hour of Power at Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. And remember, salvation through Texas music.
And you can join the thousands of people following our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Love me do.
Sixteen years ago, the Taliban was ousted from power in Afghanistan by the U.S.-led invasion. Today, they've regained control of large swaths of the country, including Helmand Province in the south, where U.S. and British troops fought some of their bloodiest battles during the war. Alia Atrafi of the BBC Afghan Service has just returned to London from Helmand Province. He and his crew got rare access to the region. Alia, this took over a year to set up. Why do you think the Taliban even allowed you to go in?
I believe for the Taliban, the motivation was that they wanted to show the world that they are the government now. We realize there's a difference between how the Taliban see themselves and how they are seen from outside. Mm. So the Taliban see themselves quite contrary to how they are seen from the outside. So they see themselves as offering more justice, as being less corrupt, as being committed to their cause, and as a result, you know, having huge areas under the control, and now offering governance as well, even though it's all, you know, it's funded by the central government in Kabul. So this is the motivation, you know, for the Taliban.
Well, you say they want to show that they are the government in Helmand Province. They were the government in all of Afghanistan, rose up out of the debris of the Soviet-Afghan war, ruled with an iron thumb, very conservative. How are they ruling in Helmand Province? And again, this is government funds coming in from, you know, Kabul, but they're running the show. How are they perceived there? Are they as rigid?
They are slightly more relaxed than the Taliban after 1996. That's partly because of their experiences, you know, new generation of Taliban, they basically grew up in cities. They've seen more of a urban life than, you know, their predecessors. But also Taliban, you know, they're sort of under pressure. You know, they learned from their previous experiences. So they want to embrace modernity, but then in the way of that is their ideology. Mm. So it's a paradox. They need that rigid ideology, you know, for their warring culture, you know, to be tough fighters. But then it interrupts them.
So on the one hand, they need to be tough because they are fighters. And we've seen Taliban fighting, but also Taliban-backed, you know, bombings, and also the Taliban that's running a region. You say relaxed a little, but a teenager tells you he was whipped because he watched a Bollywood film. Cell phones are banned for ordinary people. You had a conversation with a Taliban spokesman, and we can hear his voice just a little bit here. And he tells you the Taliban want to be friends with the rest of the world. Their quarrel is just with those who've invaded their country. What's your sense of what they feel their future role is going to be?
They want to isolate themselves from IS, who has a global agenda. So they say, look, we have a local agenda. They see that they will capture more territories and perhaps be eventually the government. And then they would like, you know, they would like this aid to be continued. You know, they would like, you know, the salaries of teachers and doctors and vaccination and everything else to be continued, because that was, in a way, the downfall of, you know, their government, you know, during the last regime, because you know, they got the international politics wrong, and, you know, suddenly all the funds dried, and they couldn't offer services, and people hated them because they were seen as, you know, brutal dictators who would beat the civilians but not give them anything in return. They were off the record. They were saying to us, look, we recognize now that, you know, if I say that, you know, I'm offering governance, people want these public services. You know, that's how they want to see.
Do you think these Taliban in Helmand Province do represent the Taliban across the board? You know, maybe wanting to moderate, you know, being able to have more power and rule more, and maybe accommodate people's desires that they not be as conservative. Do you think they represent all Taliban?
I believe so. I think in the south of the country, they do. They had conflicts amongst themselves, which on that level, I think they've generally solved that. It will be a struggle for them once they consider peace talks. But the thing is, they think they're winning now, so they're not even considering peace talks. But yes, in Helmand Province, you know, what we see is, you know, there is a sort of unity amongst the Taliban, because there were pockets of ISIS that they have defeated in those areas.
But Ali, isn't there a showdown on the horizon? Doesn't the Afghan government have to at some point go in and take back Helmand Province from the Taliban?
The Afghan government, in a way, is struggling because it's having to fill the vacuum where they were. Tens of thousands of international forces, well equipped with the latest technology. You know, the government suddenly lost all that support, and now it's having to do all that job in its own and adapt to the new changes. You know, it really is struggling.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge for the government.
Alia Atrafi with the BBC Afghan Service, speaking now from London, having just returned from Helmand Province in Afghanistan, which is being pretty much run by the Taliban. Alia, thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, a program note, stay tuned to this NPR station for day-long news about and analysis of the Comey hearings. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.